case number 2008-30369, United States of America versus Gregory Brian Hearn. 2008-30377, United States of America versus Joel Dallas Hammond. 2008-30387, United States of America versus Cassandra Wesson Collins. Mr. Gilley, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
You may proceed.
I'm Harold Gilley. I represent the appellant, Gregory Hearn. This case involves the entry into a hotel room without a warrant. The basic facts are that Mr. Hearn and Mr. Blanton were in a hotel room at one of our casinos up in Shreveport. The police had been observing them. They were in the process of getting a search warrant. My client, Mr. Hearn, went out of the hall. Three or five officers followed Mr. Hearn. As Mr. Hearn was attempting to enter into the Coke machine room, the officers arrested him. One of the officers ran back down to the room with a key that had been provided by the management of the hotel. That key didn't work. He ran back to Mr. Hearn, got his key, and went back down there.
And didn't Mr. Hearn actually give him the key?
To the extent that he was handcuffed at the time, an agent ran back down there and said, "Give me your key," and Hearn said, "It's in my pocket."
Well, he asked him, "May I have your key?"
Yeah.
And yes, and he said, "It's in my pocket." He didn't say no or "I don't have it" or
no,
whatever.
It's in my pocket.
Okay. So is that consent?
No, I don't believe it's consent when you're are handcuffed behind the back and you have three police officers there, and a police officer says, "Give me your key." I don't believe that's consent. I sure wouldn't consider it consent if it happened to me. The issues in this case are whether or not there were exigent circumstances warranting entry into the room without a warrant, and secondly, if so, were those exigent circumstances created by law enforcement? The magistrate judge held that the exigent circumstances did exist specifically because of the preservation of the destruction of evidence and for officer safety. I believe both of these would require belief that the defendants were aware of their surveillance before they would become play a part in this. Interestingly enough, what the magistrate did hold was that due to the quantity of drugs in the rooms, the officers reasonably feared that guns might also be present. Then he said, if Hearn did not return promptly from his visit to the vending machine, as Blanton probably expected him to do, it is possible that Blanton would have destroyed the
contraband. Let me ask you this.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you address the independent source rule? In other words, if there weren't exigent circumstances, but they had enough information for the warrant that they were actually fixing to try to go get from this exact same magistrate who made the findings in your case, would that be sufficient? In other words, is that another ground to uphold what the magistrate did?
No.
No, it's not. As a matter of law, you cannot independent source.
Enter a room without a warrant.
No, I understand that. But if, in fact, the question is whether we suppress the evidence, not whether they should have entered the room. And whether they entered the room is one of the questions that we look at in that. But if the information they had that they were preparing for the warrant, independent of what they found in the room, was sufficient to have authorized the warrant that was ultimately obtained, would that be a basis upon which to deny the motion to suppress, separate from the exigent circumstances?
I guess I'm not following your question. I think it's also important as part of the warrant, they use some of the evidence that they found in the room to justify the warrant.
I'm asking you to address the independent source rule in connection with your case. That's all I'm asking you to do. If there was sufficient information to have obtained the warrant without number 10, item number 10, which is what they found in the room, would that allow a denial of the motion to suppress regardless of exigent circumstances?
No. They had absolutely no evidence that evidence.
They had the drug buy. They had the confidential informant who made a drug buy in that room from your client.
That they thought was drugs, but I think we still get to the point of the importance of the Fourth Amendment is that we have a judge look at that and determine whether or not there is probable cause to go in there. They had absolutely no evidence that there were guns in the room. The informant had not reported any guns. They heard no talk of guns. There was no reasonable belief that guns were present. And as I mentioned previously, I think without reason to believe the suspect is aware of police surveillance, and the mere presence of firearms or destructible incriminating evidence does not create the exigency. And I believe that was the Munoz-Guerra case. They had no reason to suspect that Hearn was going to promptly return to the room. This was in a casino. He could have been going to gamble, which you would normally expect to happen. And there was no need to arrest him at that time.
Counsel, I'm going to ask that each side be given 2 more minutes for argument.
Thank you. I appreciate that. There was no reason to suspect that Hearn was going to be promptly returned to the room. He was going in the opposite direction from the room when the officers took after him. In other words, Hearn came out of the room. He headed down the hall. The officers took after him. In fact, there was testimony at the trial by Officer Townley that was their plan all along. They were going to try to ease into the room. He was not carrying anything which would indicate to the police officers that he was leaving the hotel. He was dressed normally. He was not carrying a briefcase. He was not carrying a suitcase. There was nothing to indicate that he was going anyplace else. And I believe other counsel will address this too. It was not an issue of, hey, you know, they might have lost him in the hotel. With some of the other defendants in the other hotel, they followed him all over the hotel for several hours. So that was not really a reason. Any risk, if there was risk, was created by the police officers in arresting Hearn. However, I think it's very important to do everything that the magistrate relied on, and anything that this court would rely on would not be actual facts. There was no actual fact, and in fact, the facts were absolutely to the opposite, that either of the appellants, Hearn or Blanton, were aware at all of the police officers. So I don't believe that issue would even come into play, that the officers might have been or the defendants might have been aware of the fact that they were under surveillance. And also the fact of the evidence that that evidence might be destroyed. Well, that would be applicable in any case that you're involved in a drug case. Police can't just say, well, there's a lot of drugs in that room. We're going to go in there because it might be destroyed. That happens any time drugs are involved or anything else that might be destroyed as a result of somebody committing an illegal activity.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Gilley representing appellant Joelle Hammond. I plan to focus my argument on 2 issues this morning. The trial court's error in finding that probable cause was existed at the time of the arrest of Joelle Hammond, and also the trial court's error in failing to find that the police officers actually created the exigent circumstances which the court later found justified the entering of room 923. There was no probable cause to believe Joelle Hammond was involved in the drug dealing with the women that were being surveilled in room 940. The only evidence that is in the record is that Mr. Hammond approached and entered the room for 10 minutes. During that time, the room had already been under surveillance by a number of police officers who had the adjoining room from which they were listening and the room across the hall from which they were watching. At that time, they had heard comments from the women who were in there about drug dealing, and that after that, they heard comments and butane lighters going on and off. But they heard nothing during the 10 minutes that Joelle Hammond was in there that would reflect he was involved.
So you don't think it's a reasonable inference that right after someone leaves to say, well, you're a real drug dealer now, would imply that the gentleman that just left bought the drugs?
Your Honor,
I'm not saying beyond reasonable doubt, but just that is a fair reading of what happened.
If it was an immediate response within a moment, but there was about a 20 to 30 minute delay between the time that statement was overheard and Mr. Hammond left the room. There was a good 20 to 30 minutes of reading of the record closely. That was not said at all during the time that Mr. Hammond was in there. In fact, Mr. Hammond, they had been reporting what was going on in that room. If there was anything drug-related that was said during the time Mr. Hammond was in there, it's inconceivable that they wouldn't have made note of that in their reports and in their records, but they didn't. There was nothing said by Mr. Hammond to indicate he was in there for drugs at all. And the fact that this man entered this room, this is a large multi-story hotel attached to a large casino. People come from all the states around there, Texas, Arkansas, Mississippi, all over Louisiana. People come by busloads to go into that hotel. They come on chartered buses. They meet people that are in there. They have friends that they go back and forth to meet in rooms. There are romantic liaisons in that hotel. There are any number of reasons why a person would enter a room with three women in there besides interest in doing a drug deal. So we don't see anything then. We know nothing about this Mr. Hammond. There's nothing to do on the record. They've been watching these women. They've gotten snitches, multiple snitches. They have never heard his name. They've never seen him. They know that there's some other dealer that they've got on the phone that they hear while they're surveilling 940. He's coming from Texas. Well, this can't be their supplier. So 2.5 hours later, after one of the women has already been arrested, down in the first floor, we have now the other two women who are leaving the room. One goes to gamble. This is a casino. That's why, in fact, most of these people come here. In fact, multiple reasons why they could come here. There's a testimony that, in fact, Ms. Tomlinson had won considerable amount of money at the casino.
How long was Hammond in the room?
I'm sorry?
How long was Mr. Hammond in the room?
10 minutes. He was in there for 10 minutes. The fact is that he had, and this I think comes out later in the transcript, had gone in there. They were friends. These people had all come from Texas. Mr. Hammond's wife, Jana, who we meet later in room 923, was a friend of these three women. So these were friends. There were other friends in there. The transcript, when I questioned one of the officers, he, in fact, Officer Haynes, testified that when he debriefed Ms. Collins, Ms. Collins, that she said Mr. Hammond and Mr. Walters were friends who had come from Texas to gamble with them. Now, he later said, oh, well, that was a mistake, that she really didn't say that. Well, it was in his report. He signed it. So these were people who had come from Texas to gamble. Some of them did drugs.
Where is it that we find this 20 to 30-minute delay between Hammond leaving the room and the you're a drug dealer now comment? Where would I find that in the record to check that?
I believe it was in the testimony of Officer Haynes. My client, it's pretty much without dispute that he entered the room at 7:50 in the evening, and he was there for 10 minutes. And then this statement about, well, now you're a real drug dealer, and those happened, the butane lighter went off about 8:30 that evening.
The butane lighter was after the you're a drug dealer comment.
It was after. Good half hour.
So when is the you're a drug dealer comment? What time is that? And where would I find that?
It's not within 30 minutes of my clients being in there. And I don't want to say for sure, but I know it was not within 20 or 30 minutes of my client being in there. That was unrelated to him. This was at the time when the women were in there, two of them talking to each other, but it in no way had a connection to Mr. Hammond.
Well, I mean, because that's not how the government presents it. They said shortly after, so you're saying quite a bit after.
Shortly only if you consider 20 to 30 minutes shortly.
Well, that's why I wanted to look at the record.
Yes, it's not within, I'm thinking 30 minutes, but certainly it's not anything that was going on while he was in there.
What does the record show with regard to the butane lighter? I thought someone said they heard a butane lighter being used. I'm not quite clear.
That was when the three women were in the room, and that was in no way connected in temporally with my client's presence. It was, I believe, before the other two women left, the two women that left around 11:20, it was well after my client was there. Had no impact, nothing to do. The one point that I do want to make, and I know I'm running down here, I think it is extremely important that in the trial court's finding that the exigent circumstances allowed for the entry to room 923, there is no discussion by the magistrate judge that that it was Officer Haynes who knocked on that door. He knocked on the door to gain entrance. And I think it's significant to look through the trial transcript and see the number of times that those police officers talked about, well, out of respect for the casino and out of business interests of the casino, we try to make our presence very short. We are undercover. We don't look like policemen. We try to get out of the public's eye just as soon as we can. And there's this pattern, this roving band of policemen from Webster Parish, Caddo Parish, Bossier Parish, and Louisiana State Troopers. They get together. They go from Caddo at El Dorado Casino. They cross into Bossier Parish. They have this mindset, we've got to get out of the public eye. We're going to get into these rooms. The testimony is there. Multiple times it's cited in my brief, the number of officers who heard Officer Haynes knock on the door. This woman was barely unclad. She had little of any clothes on. It's inconceivable that she would go to the door if she heard commotion and just open it to see what's out there. He knocked on the door. She was expecting, it's almost midnight. She's expecting her husband to come, and when she sees that it opens the door and it's not him, she closes the door and they barge in. It's how, not a knock
was the officer, how was the officer dressed when he knocked on the door?
You may answer the question.
All of these officers were in undercover dress. All of them. In fact, if you look at the videotape, you can see them all on the elevator together, and you can see them walk out of the elevator with Mr. Hammond and Ms. Nichols. They were all undercover. There were eight or nine of them around there. This process had been used where they get the suspect, and they don't even touch them. They get around them, they surround them, and they say, please come with us, we're police officers. And that's what we contend they should have done in front of 923. There was absolutely no need for them to go into a room. They had no concept of what was in, no idea who was in there, no idea whose room it was. And when they had three rooms down the hall that they had control over. So they were all undercover. None of them looked in any way like policemen. The fact that when they walked in the room and pushed in the door, Officer Michelle Sears, near the end, one of the last to testify, said there was no way you could have seen in plain view any kind of drug.
Well, then the officer knocks on the door. Just refresh my memory of what happened. He's in plain clothes. She opens the door. Then what?
She saw this gang of thugs. One of the policemen testified, yes, she probably thought we looked like thugs out there. That's what it looked like to her. And she shoved the door closed. Then the officers...
What I'm saying, I don't quite follow is that the door is open and there's a person in plain clothes and not displaying any sign of official authority. But then she slams the door in the face of the stranger.
Yes, Your Honor. What she saw when she opened the door were eight or nine people surrounding her husband, who was at that point surrounded by these people and held by them, and they were at the door.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ritchie.
May it please the court. My name is Elton Ritchie. I represent Cassandra Collins, and I want to begin by pointing out a mistake in my brief. On page 10, I incorrectly attribute the following quotation to the United States Supreme Court in Florida versus Riley. Quote, courts should bear in mind that the issue is not whether it is conceivable that someone could eavesdrop on a conversation, but whether it is reasonable to expect privacy. That quote actually comes from this court's decision in United States versus Smith and cites Justice O'Connor's concurrence in Riley, and in the course of drafting and redrafting.
I'm sorry, what is the case from the Fifth Circuit?
United States versus Smith, 978 F2nd 171, I believe, is the exact quote, and cites Florida versus Riley in support of that proposition. But I still want to begin with that proposition from Smith and the tension between that proposition and the court's holding in Jackson, which the magistrate relied on, for the proposition that no justifiable expectation of privacy in motel room conversations where they're audible to the unaided ears of government agents in an adjoining room. There is a tension between those two, and it hangs in that word eavesdropping, which is defined as listening secretly to the private conversations of others. Now, that's important, though not entirely pivotal in Ms. Collins' case, because Agent Green, in this case, was positioned in an adjoining hotel room.
So you want to set up a distinction. If I'm sitting in my hotel room and you're next door and you're screaming and yelling and, you know, whatever, carrying on, and so I hear you without any effort to do so. I'm reading a book and I wish actually you'd be quieter. That's one set of hearing. The other is where you're talking in normal tones in your hotel room and I leaped up to the door and put a glass to the door or something or lean under the crack and start listening. That's what your definition of eavesdropping. You say that the privacy right would encompass the normal conversation that I have to listen at the door to, but if you're yelling and screaming, hey, I've got drugs in my room and I'm sitting next door reading a book and I can't help but hear, the privacy would not extend to that. Is that your argument?
I think that's exactly where we're going. If we're going to have a line, that's where it should be. For example, I checked into my hotel room last night at 9 o'clock. The first thing I did was pick up my phone and call my wife. But before I did that, I didn't take a towel and shove it underneath the door to the adjoining room, nor did I open the door to see if there was someone sitting there, seeing if they could hear underneath what was going on. I spoke in normal tones so that a normal passerby shouldn't have been able to hear it inside the room. When I disrobed to take a shower, I didn't go over and take a towel and place it over the mirror, you know, assuming that there's someone might be cooperating, the hotel might be cooperating with the police and placing a camera behind my mirror so that they could see into my room. It has to do with the reasonableness of our expectations and what we expect someone, reasonable steps we take, expect them to take in order to ensure the privacy of their conversations. What Katz teaches is it's not the place that has the privacy right, it's the person's interest in their conversations. So, there is a difference between, and we've all had the experience of walking down the hallway in a hotel or even in an office building, and we hear people talking in loud tones or talking loudly over the phone. What we don't do in a civilized society is we don't stop and put our ears to the cracks in the door. Just as the Fifth Circuit said in Smith, just because peeping Toms abound doesn't give the government license to engage in that sort of invasion of privacy. And in fact, even in Jackson, the court recognized that just because the officers were lawfully in the room is not dispositive of the issue. The question still turns on the expectation of privacy.
I'm standing at my window at my house, you're talking about a peeping Tom, somebody on the road can see me. There's nothing illegal or improper about that. I ought to close my curtains. Now, if somebody sneaks into the bushes and looks up underneath maybe where the curtain is and tries to see in, that's trespass. Police couldn't just come on my property and start looking under the curtain or whatnot or however. I mean, I don't know how you peep on people. I haven't tried. But if they're standing on the roadway and my curtains are open and I'm doing whatever I'm doing, they can look and anybody else can look. So I guess here they were lawfully where they were. And so I guess if my neighbor could see into my house, I mean, that's kind of why you have curtains to some degree. If your neighbor can see into your house, you keep them closed. And in many places where they're next door real close, that's it. So they can see into your house. So your peeping Tom analogy to me doesn't...
Well, two things. One deals with vision, which operates at a greater distance than the ear. And the other deals with the fact that Cassandra Collins did just that. She walked into a private room, into a hotel, that had been rented for privacy by the occupants, and she closed the doors.
But how do you distinguish Jackson? You started off to say that Jackson, this was different from Jackson, other than the fact that you open one of the connecting doors, which in your own door, which you have access to, how does this differ from Jackson?
Well, the occupants of room 940, where Ms. Collins was, didn't open their adjoining door. They left it closed. The officer took the additional step of opening the adjoining door and placing his ear to the crack, but doing something that one would not expect.
The people who were listened to did not have access to the door that was open. As I understand it, it was one of these dual door.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they opened the door to in their own room.
Correct. No, the occupants of room 940 did not open their door.
I'm sorry?
The occupants of the room where Ms. Collin was did not open that adjoining
door. No, I understand. They did not, but the officers in the room they were in opened the door that opened into their room.
That's correct.
Okay, and that's the only factual distinction between this and Jackson. This panel is bound by Jackson. That's why I was... I appreciate your argument about reasonable expectations of privacy. I'm just trying to get out the controlling precedent here.
I understand, Your Honor. I think it does need to be reconsidered. But setting that aside, it's not pivotal to this case. Let's talk about what the police knew when they stopped Cassandra Collins in the lobby of the Diamond Jacks Hotel. They had, according to the magistrate, they had probable cause to arrest her. But that begs the question, arrest her for what? There was no particularized information relating to Cassandra Collins. What they knew was this. They had a questionable report of a purchase from a different female, described to be physically different, in a different hotel room on a different day. They had information that that female had merely moved that room. And if we take into account the statements that Agent Green had heard, all he had heard at that time was some snippets of conversation. He had heard three women talking. He heard hair dryers going. He heard water running. He heard a TV going on. He heard the word drug dealer, and that's it.
He heard a butane lighter or something. I don't quite understand that, but...
That occurs after Cassandra Collins is arrested.
Oh, afterwards.
Counsel.
Well, help me with that sequence, because what happened after the... It was after that this person had exited and been arrested, and they heard a butane lighter? I'm confused.
After Ms. Collins was arrested, what they did is they followed her down in the elevator. Two officers got behind her on the elevator. Two more got with her in the lobby. They physically took hold of her and took her outside, confronted her, demanded to know where the dope was. And at that point, they went back to the room, listened further. That's when they heard the counting of money. That's when they heard the butane lighters and information relating to that.
Well, let me ask a different way. What, if anything, had the officers learned from their surreptitious listening prior to the arrest of your client?
They'd heard the word drug dealer.
They heard what? I'm sorry?
They had heard someone say the word drug dealer, or you're a real drug dealer now. Now, three young women in a hotel room preparing to go out for the evening, and laughing, and the TV going, water running, and this is clearly jovial conversation and carrying on at normal tones. The officers admitted they had to get out and listen to it. That could just as easily have been talking about someone handing someone an aspirin or a Tylenol, not necessarily an indication of drug activity, and certainly nothing tying to Ms. Collins at all.
When was the statement made about I'm selling ice cream, or I'm the ice cream dealer now, I'm selling drugs?
Again, that was made
But that was post-arrest of your client. Is that
I'm
right?
I'm sorry. I believe that was post-arrest. The only two statements that I could find and that Agent Green could report that he heard was just he'd overheard the word drug dealer and someone saying, you're a real drug dealer now. No reference to any specific individual. They didn't even know who the individuals were in the rooms at the time.
Counsel, assuming arguendo that we agreed with you that the officers lacked probable cause to arrest Ms. Collins, would we have to remand on the issue of the consent to search? And did the consent to search dissipate the taint of the illegal seizure, if it wasn't an illegal seizure?
That's a more difficult question, but I don't think so. Because the officers, although one might be able to argue, well, they could have stopped her on reasonable suspicion. She did come from a room where there was at least some information that there might have been some drug dealing involved. But that again begs the question, what's the particularized suspicion relating to Ms. Collins? They'd never had a description of her. Her name had never come up. No one had ever indicated that she was involved in this in any manner. She was simply exiting a room from which there was some generalized information that someone might be in that room who had engaged in a drug transaction in another room several days earlier in the week. So no reasonable suspicion. So then the question becomes, well, is it a consensual encounter? And the answer to that's flat no. We know that from the testimony of the officers. We know that from the magistrate's ruling. Four police officers walk up to her as she exits an elevator, all four physically grab her by the arms, whisk her out of the lobby of the casino and into a parking garage. Those are exactly the circumstances where she's taken away, where there are no witnesses around to see what's happening and to observe on her behalf. She's being essentially secreted out of the public view.
You need to stand in front of that mic because we're recording these things.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's an arrest. That's not a consensual encounter. It could have been. They could have approached her and asked her for a consensual encounter, but they didn't. So to answer your question, I don't think you have to remand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cassier?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Do you mind picking up right where Judge Elrod's question left off, the question of if we were to find that there was no probable cause for the arrest of Cassandra Collins, what happens to her confession or her statements, I guess I should say, inculpatory statements, and the search, the consent to search?
Okay.
Do we remand for
the... There's no probable cause to arrest her.
Yes. Do we have to remand arrested? For a finding of whether the consent, even in light of the arrest, was voluntary, or is that a per se suppression?
I believe it can be, this could be termed a Terry stop. They certainly had reasonable suspicion to briefly detain...
But do we decide that?
To briefly detain her, pardon?
I'm sorry, do we decide that, or do we send it to the district court for a hearing on that subject?
You could remand it for that purpose, for the judge to determine that, but what you would have to find that there's no probable cause for that to become an issue to be decided. The court could...
That's a pretty strong...
Pardon?
That's a pretty strong Terry stop to four persons to take them all the way to the end of the parking garage.
Well, we go back to the agreement that the police officers have with the casino that they will not interfere with patrons or disturb or make it obvious that they are carrying on an investigation and making arrests when they
do. Whatever their reasons for doing, though, the question is they took control of her.
Right. They ushered her out. They didn't really surround her. I believe two of them got on either side of her by the elbow and moved her towards the parking garage, which I believe is near the elevators. And at that point, they said, we're conducting an investigation, and asked her where the dope was. And at that point, she put her purse down and said it was in her purse. They did read her Miranda rights before they asked her the question. But it is a Terry stop if you find no probable cause. But the government's position is, and if first of all, I want to call your attention to the magistrate's report and recommendation. Number one, he makes a strong series of findings of fact. No defendant has yet shown that any of those findings by the magistrate are clearly erroneous. They are supported by testimony at the hearing on the motion to suppress. So findings of fact, not clearly erroneous. They're correct. The magistrate then makes conclusions from those correct findings of fact, and those conclusions do support his determination that there was probable cause for each of the activities that the agents engaged in. There was probable cause to arrest Collins. There was probable cause to arrest Hearn. There was probable cause to arrest both Hammond and Selena Nichols, who's not on appeal here.
Well, let's talk about those findings of fact then regarding this incident with Mrs. Hammond opening the door. As I see it, there are three different explanations for that Mr. Hammond couldn't get the key card to work, and so she opened the door to help let him in, that the officer knocked on the door, and then she answered the door, and then that she just happened to, without her clothes on, open the door to see what the commotion was in the hall.
And so, the magistrate found that it was really immaterial as to whether or not, as to what the events were that happened. It happened very quickly. It was immaterial because the officers had made an arrest with probable cause of Hammond and Selena Nichols. Once they made that arrest, they knew someone else was in there because the door was opened, and that is material, that she did open the door. They knew they were going to that room. There's conflicting testimonies to whether she opened it first or it was not, there was a knock first. But whichever it was, the officers intended to gain entry there, particularly when they found out there was another person in there, for their safety and to prevent the destruction of any evidence that was there.
But did the district court actually find she opened the door not in response to a knock but to the commotion? I mean, you're saying that's an irrelevant finding? I think it's a fairly important finding. Because if the officer creates the whole circumstance of, oh, now there's an open door, I need to rush in and secure it. By knocking on it, I mean, that's a manufactured exigency.
No, the exigency was created by the arrest, if there was any exigency at all. It was
created by the
arrest.
Yeah, but they're arresting the hallway. He can't run in. They've got him now. He can't run in and grab a gun from the door, from inside the room. The only potential exigency is if Mrs. Hammond now throws open the door, whether for commotion or because he's trying to get in, and now she's in a position to perhaps reach for a gun or do something that could put the officers in danger. If they're the one creating that by knocking on the door, I mean, what would they expect to happen? Somebody's going to open it. So I think that's a very significant point.
Anyone could knock on the door. So the knocking on the door by the officers in this case happened after the arrest had occurred, after the commotion that she heard. If they knocked on the door first and then she opened the door and saw what was going on, that's the knock did not create the exigency. The exigency was created by the commotion and the arrest that occurred, and that was a proper arrest with probable cause.
So if you arrest somebody outside a hotel room, you can just barge in that hotel room and start searching it?
They did not barge in and start searching it. They barged in for their protection and to prevent the destruction of evidence.
The government does rely on exigent circumstances.
To gain entrance to the room.
Yes.
There was no search of that room immediately. They advised all three.
But to be clear, the government depends upon exigent circumstances to justify entry into the room. It's correct?
Yes and no.
All right.
The agents wanted to gain entrance to the room because they knew that this was the room where Hammond was going, and they did not know if there was someone else there or not. So they needed to find that out one way or the other. Either knock on the door and someone opens it, knock on the door and no one opens it, and they would probably have used Mr. Hammond's key to get into that room. But they wanted to make sure that there was no one else in there. There was the fear that there may be weapons, and certainly the knowledge that there was likely.
What created the exigent circumstance?
In that sense, the exigency of that particular moment was created by the arrest of Hammond and Selena Nichols in the hallway right outside that room.
Well, so the police officers created, it's fair to say, the exigent circumstances, or not?
The exigent circumstances occurred because they arrested those people at that particular time. Yes, they arrested them. And that created exigent circumstances.
Well, the police is it correct to say that the police officers created the exigent circumstances?
But it was not an improper creation. Yes, they did. They created
right
the exigent circumstances.
Right or wrong, they created it.
They created it by performing an arrest right outside that hotel room.
Because, I mean, that's not what the district court found. The district court found Mrs. Hammond opened the door, and that created the circumstance. It's kind of the opposite of what you're saying.
I don't believe that is correct. The magistrate said, I believe, in his report and recommendation that I don't know if he used the words immaterial, but it did not make any difference to his conclusion as to the propriety of the officers entering the room at that point. I would like to go back to the discussion of where the ice cream man selling ice cream everywhere and the overhearing the conversations in room 940. Agent William Green's testimony in volume 1 of the motion to suppress at approximately page 122 and on through a good ways there. That created, it is determined that there were three women present in that room during the time there was conversations about, now you're a real dope dealer, and someone else said, yeah, I'm just like the ice cream man now selling ice cream everywhere. There was general talk, laughter, a constant butane lighter going off like someone was smoking meth. And then one girl, Collins, left about 10 minutes later. And then she was arrested. So all of this conversation had taken place before Collins was arrested. The important thing I think that needs to be determined is that there was probable cause for each of the three arrests. There was probable cause for Collins' arrest after she left the hotel room, that there was obviously discussion of dope. There was also counting of money in that room, and Agent Green's testimony is to that effect also. There was the agents had probable cause to arrest her.
I'm sorry, I just want to read from what the court found, because we have this confusion in the record about what he actually found. He said, he goes into about all this discussion. It says, the facts show that when the officers made the arrest of Hammond and Nichols in the hallway outside of room 923, Mrs. Hammond opened the door to room 923 to see what was going on. When Mrs. Hammond opened the door to 923, the officers did not know who she was, whether she was armed with a weapon, and so on. And that gets into the whole discussion. So that's what I was talking about.
All right, that is correct then. That is what happened. She opened the door after the arrest. There was some testimony about Agent Haynes knocking on the door first, and the magistrate made no finding with regard to that.
We need to send it back for him to decide whether he credited Agent McCullough or not.
For what purpose?
Whether or not the officer knocked on the door.
I think not. Once she opened the door, the agents knew someone else was in there. Whether he knocked first, didn't knock first, is irrelevant. She opened the door, they knew someone else was there. If she had not opened the door, they were probably going to use Hammond's key to get in, knock to see if someone else would let them in.
The part that he didn't resolve, I'm sorry, I think there's just a misunderstanding. The part he didn't resolve the conflict is about whether Mrs. Hammond allowed them into the room, not about why she opened the door.
All right,
he found she didn't know she opened the door because of the commotion. The conflict was whether, because it says, Agent Haynes asked Mrs. Hammond for permission to enter the room. Sergeant Townley testified Mrs. Hammond attempted to close the door. Agent Hammond said he took it as an invitation. Then he says we don't have to resolve that conflict because once she opens the door, we got a problem.
Right.
That's what the court found.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
But the problem is that if they say that they're concerned that someone's at the door and that there's an issue for the officer's safety at that point because somebody's opened the door and they may have a weapon, if they've been the ones that have actually knocked on the door to precipitate the door opening, then couldn't they be manufacturing the exigency?
Your Honor, I will call the court's attention to U.S. versus Maldonado. That is a case in which the officers had probable cause to arrest an individual. They asked the individual to come out to the driveway. They actually arrested him in the driveway. They knew there had been another individual at the mobile home where the arrest took place at some point, and they weren't sure if that person was still there. They looked and saw an individual peeking through that, I believe it was a doorway, it might have been a window, and then shut the door or the window, whatever. And at that point, they ran in to the room, to the mobile home, I believe is what it was. And then conducted a very quick protective sweep. That is very similar to what happened here. A legitimate arrest takes place outside. There is someone inside. The officers either strongly suspect or want to check it out to make sure that there is someone there and to secure evidence.
Does the legitimacy of the arrest of Hammond foreclose the the argument of manufactured exigency? In other words, no one's fleeing the scene. The officers made a decision to make an arrest. The argument is that by making that decision to arrest, which was unnecessary, the timing, they provoked the confrontation. They created the exigency from all that followed. How do you respond to that?
I respond to that by saying this was a growing investigation. It developed over approximately a 12-hour period. It involved two different casino hotels, and a lot of individuals, some of which the officers actually did not even pursue at all. And they had arrested Hearn, they had arrested Collins, They knew Hammond and Selena Nichols were involved. Selena had come from the room where lots of drug stuff was going on. Collins had been had left that room where a lot of drug stuff was going on. Selena had gone to the lobby to meet with a male, and the officers knew this from the conversation. She was going to meet a man in the lobby, and it was Hammond who showed up approximately 5 or 10 minutes after she arrived in the lobby, and then they went up in the elevator to the ninth floor where room 940 was. They thought that's where she was going. They ended up going to a different room. They had probable cause to arrest both these people, and they chose to arrest them at that point.
I appreciate that, but the thrust of my question is a bit different. The police officers here may have had probable cause to effect the arrest, but to make the arrest as they did plainly created an exigency for all the circumstances that precipitated all that followed. Now, what your argument has to be is that they could do that. In other words, that someone left this, although the person were not fleeing, can make the arrest, so forth. The principle is that the government has control over the timing of the circumstances, they cannot make time their move in a way that creates the accident circumstances to make the entry. Now, the answer to that is, well, they didn't have control over the timing. Well, that means that they don't have control over the timing if the individual is arrested, is fleeing the scene, or they, in other words, they must act. And I thought under this record that Hammond, there was no suggestion that, correct me if, because I haven't seen this record, that Hammond was fleeing the scene, that Hammond's departure on its face was didn't suggest anything. They just elected to make their move at that time, right or wrong. And now you help me with your argument now.
Well, the officers can arrest an individual once they have probable cause to arrest them.
No question.
And that is what they did. They chose to exercise their discretion to arrest the two of them together at that point. There's no discussion of why they chose that particular time. They just did. They knew they had a search warrant for room 940, which had to be executed, according to Agent Sears, before midnight, and it was after 11 at this point.
Well, see, the distinction between Aurelio Morales and Vega and Munoz cases is the question. It spins on whether or not those suspects were fleeing, not on the legitimacy of the arrest or not. And that's what I'm trying to focus on.
Well, they were not necessarily fleeing, but the officers didn't know where they were going to go or what they were going to do next anyway. They were obviously going to a hotel room on the ninth floor, so they weren't fleeing. But
when four officers make it, was it three or four officers make an arrest right outside the hotel room door, it's difficult to conclude that the officers weren't prepared then they were making their move and all that followed, and not waiting for a warrant.
No, they were not waiting for an arrest warrant at that point. They were waiting for the search warrant, and it had arrived.
If they had not, if they had not arrested Hammond, but just followed Hammond, what would? But they then went up. Would they then have had the circumstances to make entry into the room?
If they had not arrested him but simply followed him?
In other words, if you don't arrest them, then all that follows, somebody comes, you create the commotion, they open the door, and then all that follows from that. Once you take away the arrest, then the question is, you don't have a basis for going in there. You got to wait on the warrant.
No, that would be
correct. You got a warrant?
They could not go into the room without a warrant, unless they had... unless they had done a confidential informant going in to buy drugs from them or something like that. But they did not have time for that, and they didn't have any basis to do that.
Unless they created the exigency. That's the key to it.
I think what you're trying to say, and I'm sorry if I'm interpreting, but what you're trying to say is that they made the arrest for the purpose of getting into the room?
It's not a question of purpose. If the officers control the timing and they create the exigency, they cannot, by doing so, escape the necessity of a warrant. Now, it doesn't follow necessarily that the warrant would not provide an independent source on these facts. I'm just trying to focus on what I think some of the issues are.
I believe in that whole day, they were making arrests throughout the day. They arrested Hearn. They had earlier that day arrested one of the confidential informants, the woman who went in and made the buy from Hearn and Blanton.
But not outside the door of the room they were going to enter.
I'm sorry.
But those arrests were not made there at the hotel. They were made away.
That's correct. But they didn't even know about room 923. The officers did not choose that room. They didn't know that 923 was the room that Hammond and his wife were occupying. They had no knowledge of that. They thought Hammond and Selena Nichols were going to 940, which the officers knew about. When they turned and went the wrong way, it was like, ooh, let's follow these guys and see what's going on. And at that point, they knew they felt they had to make the arrest at that point.
Wow.
Your Honor, I don't know. They chose to do it.
Records? I know you don't know, but what does the record show, if anything, about that?
The record doesn't show.
Did they offer any explanation for why they made the arrest at the time?
They had probable cause, and they chose to do it at that time. There was nothing in the record about that at all.
Okay.
I have a similar question regarding Defendant Hearn to the question I asked about Defendant Collins earlier. If we were to determine that there were no exigent circumstances or that the exigent circumstances were manufactured or something in that regard, would we have to remand on the consent to search that warrant?
Now, which room are you talking about?
This is the room that Hearn was in.
That Hearn and Blanton were in?
Blanton were in.
The officers searched that room pursuant to a search warrant. The search warrant arrived around 4 o'clock, it was actually executed around 7 that evening. They waited.
They waited to search that room until
they did
after.
Not, right. They made entry into the room using Hearn's key, and the only evidence that was seized at that moment was in plain view in Blanton's lap, I believe, at the time.
He's holding a bag.
And they had information from the confidential informant that Blanton was a person who, in fact, she had pointed him out in the garage below before she ever even went to make the purchase as a friend who was with Hearn at the time, and that they were dealing drugs. So they knew that this was a person they could arrest, and they had probable cause to arrest him also. But the only thing they seized was what it was in plain view in Blanton's possession, and then they waited for the warrant before they actually searched that room. And the warrant arrived, I think it was somewhere between 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock that evening. They executed that search warrant. By then, I believe Collins had been arrested, and the search warrant for 940, the agents who had prepared that one for the El Dorado, then went back and began preparing the subsequent warrant for the Diamond Jack's hotel.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just a few brief comments because of my 1 minute. First of all, government counsel implied that there was a big difference in the findings of facts by the magistrate. I don't believe that there are any difference in the findings of fact by the magistrate. She also seemed to imply to me that since they had probable cause to search that room, everything's okay. Well, everything is not okay when you enter into a dwelling or a hotel room without a warrant. Before you go down here, number one, do you have probable cause? Well, I'm not going to stand here and say that they didn't have probable cause to go in that room. But the next question you have to ask yourself, was there exigent circumstances? Okay, now if you get past both those, you've got one final question that you have to answer, and that is, did the police create the exigent circumstances? I also...
I thought the district court found that the door was opened in 923 in response to attempts to enter with a key card.
I'm in the other room, the other hotel.
Okay.
No, there wasn't. And mine is so far removed from what you were asking my counsel and wife here about the disturbance outside the hall. There was no disturbance, and it was not outside the door. There were none. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm sorry. I was still in 923.
There's a mindset in the undercover cops that were running this whole operation that once you arrest somebody, that gives you the right to move into the room. That seems to be their modus operandi. So I think that is a confusion. On the flip side, 1711, they had probable cause to go in, but they didn't have the warrant yet. Room 923, they had no probable cause. They didn't have a clue. There was no probable cause. So when you look for that as the two-pronged test for whether exigent circumstances existed, it didn't. There certainly was no agreement on the part of Mr. Hammond that all of the fact findings in the magistrate's report were accurate. We made a clear position that he did not address the knock. Agent Haynes's testimony was that he did knock on the door. The record will support a finding that multiple officers agreed he did knock on the door.
Least one testified that there was a commotion and she opened the door. And so when there's conflicting evidence, the district judge can find what they find credible. Right?
You can answer.
No, I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully. There were multiple officers. We made a point of calling seven or eight of these officers to show what really went on because there was a considerable effort to spin the evidence and to spin what happened. That's why we called so many of them and to show what really happened. I don't think that a full and careful reading of the record will show that Officer Haynes knocked on the door because he wanted to get in there, as government counsel argued. He wanted to get in there. He wanted to get in there. The other guys wanted to get into 1711. That's the way they do things. Get them into the room and look it over. That was their whole purpose. It's inconceivable that a woman who is naked would hear a commotion and just swing open the door to see what it's all about without somebody knocking.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
With regard to Cassandra Collins, I don't believe the government has shown any particularized findings of probable cause as to her to believe that she committed any particular offense at the instance that she was walking out of that door of room 940. Now, to further address the question of whether the consent that she gave at the time of her arrest would remove the taint of that unlawful arrest, the answer is no. We look to three points: the temporal proximity of the illegal conduct, that being the unlawful arrest, and the consent.
I mean, isn't that inherently fact-based? So if we get that far, don't we have to send it back to the district court to decide that?
Well, I believe it.
Because you're looking at factors, the timing, the this, the that. How did she feel? Was she afraid? Was she pulled in the garage? I mean, there has to be evidence to support such a finding, but isn't that something the district court should have the opportunity to look at if we decide there was no probable cause for the arrest?
I think that those facts are fairly well developed in the record. I suppose the court could do that if it found it necessary. But I think that it's pretty obvious from the facts in the record that consent occurred immediately after she was taken into custody forcibly by four police officers, removed from the lobby, and taken into the garage, and that the whole purpose for that was to secure that search of her person.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gilley, Ms. Gilley, and Mr. Ritchie, who all have been court-appointed in this matter for your service. And also, Mr. Hogan was court-appointed in the previous matter, and we belatedly thank Mr. Hogan for his service. Thank you.